Bringing you the latest case law updates on the legal aspects of law enforcement. This is Broadcast Blue.
Welcome to Broadcast Blue. I'm your host, Bruce Allen Barnard, and I'm delighted you've joined me for this episode of Broadcast Blue, where we bring you the latest developments in the legal aspects of law enforcement. First thing I want to talk about tonight in this podcast is to notify you of a change in the format. You spoke and we listened. We had some feedback on the first episode, and folks said, hey, look, you ought to do this on topics and not just a bunch of cases. So the audio podcast will be on specific topics from now on, and we will incorporate recent cases into that topical discussion. Now, the video podcasts that come out every week will continue to be an in-depth analysis of a very recent case from one of the federal circuits, but the audio podcast will be based on topics. The topic of this episode of Broadcast Blue is cell site location information, often abbreviated CSLI. I'm going to talk a little bit about this over the next 45 minutes or so, and hopefully give you some information that you can use. First, let me give you a little bit of a background. We talk about cell telephones and cell towers, how they operate, how these mobile telephone devices work, and how the cell towers function as well. Well, the mobile phone obviously has to connect, the signal has to connect to a tower in order for you to get the continuity that you need and the signal that you need in order to make a call on your mobile phone. These towers are spaced out in rural areas. They're further apart than they are in, say, urban areas. They can be much closer together. But all of these towers have fundamentally the same basic type of construction and operate in the same type of way. There's an antenna array, and this antenna on the tower, these arrays, there are three of them. It's divided like a pie. If you split a pie into three sections, if you think of a circle as 360 degrees, there are three antennas that are arrayed in 120 degree sectors. And the three antennas, the three 120 degree sectors come together to give you the 360 degrees of coverage from the tower. When you connect to a tower, you are connected to one of those specific arrays. And so if you know which tower a telephone is connected to, and you know which array on that tower that it's connected to, it can give you a general location of the device. If you know where the tower is, and you know that the mobile device is connected to that one side of that tower, one sector, you know it's within that 120 degree sector of that tower. And then with signal strength and whether it connects or doesn't connect, where it loses connection can help indicate the how far it is from the tower and even the motion of travel. When you look at how cell phones connect and then disconnect as they connect to another tower, you get a sense of movement. When I drove up to Maine not too long ago, you know, as I drove from Florida to Maine, I would disconnect from one tower and connect to another. And so if you looked at the cell towers historically, the cell towers that I was connected to over that period of time, you can get an indication for the direction of travel, the route that I took, and where I was at any specific point along that path. And that's the kind of information that you get by knowing how the phone is connected, which cell tower a mobile phone is connected to. The mobile phone is a dumb device, and it will connect to any tower, anything it perceives to be a tower that has the highest signal strength, that wants the best signal possible. So it will connect to the tower that where it has the best signal and the highest signal strength. Now, cell tower location information, as you've probably already gathered, isn't specific like GPS, but it's helpful. It's informational. It gives you a general sense of where a person is, or at least where that person's cell phone is, at any particular moment in time based on the tower that it's connected to. It can't be connected to a tower in Tallahassee, Florida, if the phone is physically present in New York City, for example. And it gives you an idea of where that cell phone is at a particular time. And the reason that we know this is because the cell tower information, that the cell site location information, is retained by the service providers. They know when you change from one tower to another. Now, it used to be that a lot of that had to do with roaming. If, for those of you old enough to remember the first generation of mobile telephones, they weren't handheld. They weren't cell phones. They mounted in your car. You had this thing that you put in your trunk. The receiver went in the trunk. You had a little antenna that mounted on the back windshield, and you had a handset up there by the transmission, the shifter, your transmission knob there. And it was had a cord on it. You would punch the numbers on the back of the phone. It wasn't even cordless. But back then, you know, you would roam, and you had coverage in your area locally, but when you roamed, it might cost you more. And since there was a cost vehicle associated with a cost associated with roaming, they kept track of when you were roaming and when you weren't. They kept track of where you were connected and where you weren't connected. And if you connected internationally, it could get even more expensive. So the whole concept of the cell service providers retaining cell tower location is inherent into the way they do business. It's a part of the records that they normally keep in the regular course of their business. And so this is information of this historical CSLI, which I want to talk about in a second, can become very, very important, can be a very useful tool in criminal investigations. Since I've already touched on historical cell site location information or historical CSLI, let me say that there's a difference between historical CSLI and current cell tower location information. This historical information is kept in the course of business, and the cell service providers retain this history of the towers and which towers this particular cell phone has been connected to. But if you want to know the current location, if you're talking about trying to determine where a phone is right now without looking at historical records, then that requires some type of interaction. Basically, you're going to the phone and saying, tell me where you are right. Tell me what tower you're connected to right now. I want to know which tower you're connected to right now. And that gives you more current location information, more what would be more akin to real-time cell site location information based on this interaction, this active step that's being taken, whether the cell service provider does it with a ping, and we're going to talk about pinging in just a little bit, or if you're using some type of device to fool someone's cell phone into thinking that you are a cell tower when you're really not, which is the whole concept of using a Stingray-type devices that we'll talk about as well. But there's a difference between the historical cell site location information that is retained by the providers and then trying to use either a provider or a device in order to acquire this real-time cell tower location information. While I'm touching on background information, I also want to talk a little bit about the third-party doctrine. I've already kind of alluded to this. I said with the historical cell site location information, it's kept in the normal course of business. And the concept of the third party doctrine is a rule of law that says, look, you can't expect privacy in information that is freely given to third parties. If you freely give information out to a third party, especially a commercial third party vendor, then it's not reasonable to expect privacy in this information. And why is this concept of privacy, whether it exists under the third-party doctrine, so important? And that's because of the definition of a search, the CATS definition of a search, where that a person, if a person has manifested a subjective expectation of privacy in an area or an information, and we as a society are willing to say that subjective belief in privacy is objectively reasonable, then it's a search under the Fourth Amendment. Remember, anytime you have a search under the Fourth Amendment, it has to be reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, which is going to require either a warrant or one of the judicially recognized exceptions. If it's not a search under the Fourth Amendment, then you don't have to have a warrant or a judicially recognized exception, what I call a JRE. And so it becomes really important as to whether or not obtaining this type of cell site location information is a search or not under the Fourth Amendment becomes a fundamental of the key part of the analysis in the decisions that deal with cell site location information. So the third party, under the third party doctrine, the concept is any information that you freely provide to a third party, especially a commercial third party, it's not reasonable to expect privacy in that. Now, let me also talk a little bit about United States versus Jones. And there's a number of cases that are United States versus Jones, so we're going to have to start trying to keep track of these cases, no pun intended, because the one I'm talking about is the tracking case. If you remember the United States Supreme Court decision that came out in January of 2012, a landmark decision in United States versus Jones, where Justice Scalia's opinion, which was joined by Justice Sotomayor to make the majority opinion in the rule of law, fundamentally resurrected that old school Olmstead definition of a search, where a physical intrusion into one of the four constitutionally protected areas, persons, houses, papers, or effects, would constitute a search under the Fourth Amendment. In that particular Jones case, that dealt with the attaching of a GPS tracking device, a slap and dash GPS tracking device to someone's vehicle, and the court held that that was a search, just the physically touching an automobile, which is an effect. That's one of those four constitutionally protected areas. Physically touching the automobile for the purpose of gathering information constituted a search under the Fourth Amendment. So after Jones, we had that resurrection of the old school definition of a search that's based on trespass theory. Once the Jones decision came out, it sits side by side with Katz. So we have the Jones definition of a search based on that physical intrusion into one of the four constitutionally protected areas. And we still have Katz, which is that intrusion by the government using any of the five senses into an area where a person has a reasonable expectation of privacy from being observed in that with that particular sense, be it the sense of sight, hearing, smell, taste even, or touch. So that's the Katz and Jones distinction that we have. There was a very, very important part of Jones, and since it didn't become the majority opinion, it's kind of hovering out there. So the lower court in Jones had decided the case, had ruled that the act of monitoring, tracking someone for 28 straight days, 24/7 tracking of someone, was so invasive from a privacy standpoint that it triggered Fourth Amendment scrutiny. And they embrace something that's referred to as the mosaic theory or the mosaic concept, where individual pieces of information are reasonable to be taken without a warrant. But when you did the extended surveillance of some type, especially electronic surveillance, this extended surveillance of someone over a period of time becomes unreasonable when you get enough information. You get more than just individual pieces. The sum is greater than just the putting together of the pieces. And that's the whole fundamental concept with mosaic theory. Now, the court in Jones did not embrace mosaic theory. In fact, Justice Scalia's opinion, which became the majority opinion, didn't deal with mosaic. It resurrected that old trespass definition of a search. But there were four of the nine justices. Justice Alito's opinion would have embraced a mosaic theory. Justice Alito, in his opinion, in which three other justices joined, would have made the mosaic the rule of law and would have pulled this concept of extended surveillance over a period of time into the possibility of having a search under the Fourth Amendment. And you might be wondering to yourself, well, self, if it wasn't the majority opinion, if it didn't become the rule of law, why is it such a big deal? And it's such a big deal because of the Sotomayor concurrence. And Justice Sotomayor had a concurring opinion, which in the end she sided with Justice Scalia. And so that physical trespass definition of a search was resurrected. But before she voted and went that way, she spent a lot of time extolling the virtues of the mosaic theory and of Justice Alito's decision as well, which kind of left us with the feeling that if the court ever had a case come up where there wasn't a physical trespass and it was totally being decided on privacy interest, then it's possible, if the justices voted the same way as they did in Jones for the same reason, that you'd get five of the nine justices embracing mosaic theory. And so even though it didn't become the rule of law in Jones, it really lingered. It had an extension on its life there based on the Sotomayor concurrence. Sounds a little bit like a Jason Bourne movie, but the Sotomayor concurrence. But anyway, that's a very important case. If you haven't taken the time to read United States versus Jones, you really, really need to sit down and read that Supreme Court decision and read the Justice Sotomayor's concurring opinion and carefully read what Justice Alito had to say as well. Very, very important case. So that gives you the background information that you need. Now I'm going to start talking about the CSLI and both the historical CSLI and the real-time CSLI. And these cases are going to refer to these fundamental concepts. So it's important. It was important for me to spend that first 15 minutes of this broadcast just giving you that background information before I actually got into the specifics. Let me start with historical CSLI and talk about that a little bit and understand that from a fundamental standpoint and another little piece of background, you know, communication information has routing. And whenever people communicate, unless they're yelling at one another across a crowded room, if you're using some type of communication network or some type of medium in order to communicate, the signal has to know where to go. And so there is communication routing or communication addressing information that is associated with communications. With the telephone, it is the telephone number that you dial. When you dial someone's telephone number, whether it's with a cell phone or a landline, you dial that area code and that number, and it tells the system where to connect you to and where to make the phone ring. So there's this communication routing information. And then once your communication is routed and the person picks up on the other end, now you've got actual communication, actual communicative content that's taking place. There's communication that's occurring between the people on the two ends of this line at these two different numbers identified by their telephone numbers, which are the communication routing information. Now, it didn't take long in the use of gizmos. Whenever there's some type of gizmo created that can help with law enforcement, it certainly doesn't take long for law enforcement to use it. And so there was a device that came out, and you've heard of it, a pin registers and trap and trace devices. But a pin register registers the numbers on a telephone that are dialed, that are outgoing as they go out. And it was a device, and back in the old day, it basically just counted clicks because that's how you dialed the telephone back in the rotary servo mechanical switching and routing that took place. And pin registers were being used, and obviously the information came about. The LEOs used the pin registers. They discovered who the target, Smith in the particular case I'm going to cite, the numbers that Smith was dialing, and that information was incriminating. And so they go to introduce that information at trial. The defense attorney uses the defense F word. That's not fair, right? Must be a search under a Fourth Amendment. They argue that obtaining the information is a Fourth Amendment search. And why would they do that? Well, they do it because if it's a search under the Fourth Amendment, it has to be reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, which means, again, you have to have a warrant or a JRE. And so if they can get the court to agree that it's a search and it was done without a warrant and without a judicially recognized exception, then they can get it held to be a Fourth Amendment violation, and they can try and seek to have the exclusionary rule kicked in to have the evidence kicked out. And that's exactly what happened in Smith versus Maryland in a Supreme Court case that was decided back in 1979, a great year, the year I graduated from high school. Use of the court ruled in Smith versus Maryland, the Supreme Court said that the use of the pen register was not a search and that it wasn't reasonable for someone to expect privacy in the numbers that they dialed because the numbers were freely provided to the third-party telephone company. And again, this gets back to the concept of providing the party, the third-party information, providing information. There's no privacy in the numbers that you dial because you're giving that to a commercial third-party vendor. And the court held that the use of a PIN register was not a search. And that was important because that meant that this information that they had was that was obtained without a warrant, without a JRE, was not excluded. It wasn't a search under the Fourth Amendment to use a pen register. And that's a very key case, the Smith versus Maryland case, 442 U.S. 735, again back in 1979. So that was the initial concept of where there was no REP, that reasonable expectation of privacy. There was no REP in communications routing information. Now, there was REP in the communication itself, but not in the routing information. And again, this is 1979. Katz was decided in 1967, and Jones wasn't out until 2012. So in 1979, you're right in the middle of the Katz era, when the only definition of a search was that privacy definition of a search from Katz versus United States. So that's very, very important also to realize. So the court said, you know, no REP in communications routing or communication addressing information. Well, the telephone gave way to email. And we were now communicating back in the early stages, back when you had to have dial-up, back when most people went through either AOL or Prodigy or CompuServe in order to get to the internet through one of these providers. We had email addresses, and we started sending email to each other. And email was one of those game changers, one of the disruptive technology that really kind of changes the way people live. I mean, it's hard to imagine life before email for a lot of people. And for some of the folks listening to this, you don't know life before email, some of you younger folks. But it was an absolute game changer. But what does the email have in common with the telephone? Well, it has communication routing information. If you send someone an email, you expect that email to go to the email address to which it's being sent, right? You have this email addressing information, communications addressing information, and you don't expect it to go anywhere else. So when you write a letter or send an email and you put someone's email address in there, it's the email address is how it gets found. And your email address is the return address. And so that you have this communication addressing information. And so the whole concept of this no REP in communications routing information was extended to email addresses and IP addresses. And it was also eventually extended to cell tower connection information, what cell tower you're connected to. Now, Congress passed a statute called the Stored Communications Act, and that's codified in Title 18 of the United States Code in Sections 2701 through 2712. I believe it's Chapter 121, but Sections 2701 through 2712, the Stored Communications Act. Congress raised the bar on communication transaction information, such as addressing information, because the Supreme Court had said that it was not a Fourth Amendment issue to use PIN registers, for example, and to put a PIN register on someone's telephone or to put a PIN register on someone's email address, or that the use of a PIN register was not a Fourth Amendment issue. And so There was no protection. There was no limit to what the government or anyone. You could put a PIN register on your neighbor's phone, right? There was no limit to what could be done with the PIN register. I mean, anyone could use it and do anything. So Congress stepped in, and they raised the bar. Now, understand that the Constitution provides a baseline of protection that people have from certain types of government action. And Congress is always free to raise the bar, right? If the Constitution doesn't apply, as was the case with the use of PIN registers and this communication routing information, basically Congress is raising the bar from nothing, from no protection to some protection. And that's what they did with this transactional information under the Stored Communications Act, or the SCA. And without the act, the communication routing information was not protected. But as a result of the act, again, 18 U.S.C. sections 2701 through 2712, as a result of that, and specifically obtained in section 2703D, you have to obtain a court order in order to obtain this transactional information, right? In order to either use a device or in order to get this historical stored communications, right? So the whole concept, of this with 2703D in the historical context became pretty important. Now, Congress also raised the bar with respect to the use of the PIN register, and we have the PIN and Trap Statute. So if you want to use a PIN register to capture the information, future information of the numbers that a person dials are the email addresses that someone sends email to, then you use a pin and trap order, a PRTT order, right? Because Congress raised the bar on the use of pin registers with the concept of the pin and trap order, statutorily raised the bar. They raised the bar on historical transactional information with the Stored Communications Act. And so in order to get stored email addresses, if you wanted to see, you wanted to know who is this person emailed from this email account and who has emailed them, you're talking about looking at this historical information that is considered transactional information, and you can only get to that with a 2703D order. Now, the standard for a 2703D order is reasonable grounds, which is less than probable cause, and in LEO speak, it's practically the functional equivalent of reasonable suspicion. So it's less than PC. You've got to be able to articulate the facts to show you have reasonable grounds to show why it is that this order should be issued to give you this transactional information. But that's a less of a burden than probable cause. It's a lot easier to get a 2703D order than it is to get a warrant. And so the fact that Congress required this at all, without the Stored Communications Act, if you wanted the historical transactional information, you could get it with just a subpoena. Because remember, the Fourth Amendment didn't apply. And so Congress raised the bar. They raised the bar from nothing to the 2703D order. Cell site location information is considered to be transactional information under the Stored Communications Act. So if you want historical cell site location information, then you ostensibly under the Stored Communications Act, you can get that with a 2703D order. And remember, that raised the bar. Without the Stored Communications Act, you could have got to that with just a subpoena. So the Stored Communications Act actually made it harder for us to get this transactional information, including historical cell site location information, than it would have been otherwise without the order. So we had a case, Carpenter versus United States, that was decided in the Sixth Circuit back in April of 2016, and the defense attorney argued that obtaining historical cell site location information is a Fourth Amendment search. Now, you have to understand, this is 4 years after the Jones decision has taken place, and there's still a lot of talk about this mosaic concept, about you get a lot of information, a lot of historical information, and Justice Sotomayor specifically addressed the concept of maybe we need to revisit the third-party doctrine when it comes to digital data, because it's just so voluminous and pervasive, and and there's just so much of it that the potential for and the privacy invasion is much, much higher. And it's emboldened defense attorneys to kind of make these arguments. And the defense attorney did. In Carpenter versus United States, they argued that historical cell site location, there was privacy in it, that it was reasonable to expect privacy in historical cell site location information, even though it's provided to a third party, kind of rejecting the third party doctrine in favor of the concept of mosaic. And the Sixth Circuit rejected the argument. They cited Smith, which you may recall back when I talked about originally. They cited Smith versus Maryland, talking about no privacy in this communication routing information. And when you're connected to a cell tower, that's communication routing information. Which tower are you communicating with? Is your phone communicating with? So the Sixth Circuit rejected the argument. They cited Smith, and then they distinguished Jones. They distinguished physically attaching a device and tracking someone over extended period of time. They distinguished Jones, and they cited Smith, and they rejected the defense's argument. But writ of cert was filed with the Supreme Court, and it was granted. And oral arguments before the Supreme Court are expected within the next few weeks, next month in October, just a few weeks from now, with a written decision to follow a couple months after that. So when it comes to historical CSLI, you've got to stay tuned. You have to see what happens in Carpenter versus United States. Will the Supreme Court decide now that the things have changed and societal norms and expectations are different now, and that whereas it wouldn't have been objectively reasonable to expect privacy in your cell site location information a few years ago, have we changed? Has societal expectations changed to where it is now reasonable to expect privacy in that information? And we'll have to stay tuned for that. Have to see what happens in the Supreme Court case in Carpenter versus United States, and hopefully then that'll be out in a few months. And stay tuned for information. So that's your historical. That's the status of your historical cell site location information. But what about current location? What about if you're trying to figure out where someone's currently at by using this cell information? Well, there are different ways to do that. First, you can use a provider to determine the general location of a phone through the pinging of the cell phone. Pinging, when you ping a phone, before GPS-enabled phones, when a cell phone was pinged, the cell company would determine the tower of connection. Now, it's really kind of historical, because what you're doing is asking the phone, what's the last tower you were connected to? But when you have immediate history, when something just happened a second ago, and you keep pinging, okay, where were you just connected to? Okay, where were you just connected to? Okay, where were you? You ping this phone over and over and over, you get what is practically real-time location information through the pinging. Now, going back to the Stored Communications Act, if it's historical information, and this is when this ping, even though it's immediate history, it's historical. Under Title 18 of the United States Code, again, and inside the Stored Communications Act, this is in Section 2702C. It allows for the disclosure of non-content information. In other words, not the communication content, but any of the other type of information, either transactional information or subscriber information, to a governmental entity if the provider in good faith believes that an emergency involving danger of death or serious physical injury to any person requires disclosure without delay of information relating to that emergency. In that case, no 2703D order is required. And so what this section of the Stored Communications Act practically does is carves out an exigent circumstances-like statutory exception to the 2703D order, kind of like exigent circumstances in the emergency doctrine carve out an exception to the warrant requirement for a Fourth Amendment search. It's like a statutory equivalent to exigent circumstances, and it allows for someone to get to the government entity, the LEOs in this particular case, to get to this information if they have an emergency. Look, we don't have time to do a 2703D order. We need to ping this phone now. This is a life or death situation. We have a kidnapped person. We have an escaped murderer. We've got some type of exigent circumstances where there is an emergency involving danger of death or serious physical injury. And then they can get under this exception under 2702C4, they can get this exception through the statutory exigent circumstances and not have to have a 2703D order. There was a case that came out of the Second Circuit. You might recall reading about this case, United States versus Carabello. The officers filled out an exigency request form, and they requested Sprint. They did it through the form. They didn't do a 2703D order. They fulfilled the statutory requirements under 2702. This 2702C4 request, and they requested Sprint to identify the last tower connected, and they pinged the phone 15 times under this exception to locate Carabello at a McDonald's, and I ended up snagging him there. And the court held the pinging was not a search that required a warrant, and that the cell site location information was properly obtained under the exigent circumstances, the 2702 exception to the 2703D requirement. In either case, in any case, it wasn't a Fourth Amendment issue. And that's no small thing to point out. And the reason is because even if they had violated 2702C and 2703D, it would not have led to the imposition of the exclusionary rule, because the exclusionary rule is a constitutional remedy for a Fourth Amendment violation, and there is no statutory exclusionary rule for SCA violations, for violations of the Stored Communications Act. The remedies are in the statute, and the remedies do not include the exclusion. So that's a important little point there. But anyway, the whole point of this particular talking about pinging a cell phone, it's where you use the cell provider in order to provide you with that information. Now, if the phone is GPS enabled, like it was in United States versus Skinner, when you ping the phone, it won't just give you the tower location, it'll give you GPS location. The phone will tell you it's GPS information, which gives you a lot more specific and accurate location information than just knowing which tower this thing is connected to. I mean, it very much narrowly defines, and if anybody uses GPS, Waze, or any of the other GPS types of driving tools, you know how accurate this is, and much, much more accurate than what tower they're connected to. So they were pinging this GPS-enabled pay-as-you-go burner phones, I guess you would call it, as these guys were driving through the desert. They kept pinging the phone, and they got this GPS information. And the defense tried to argue that this was a search under the Fourth Amendment to ping the phone this way. And the court said, and this is a quote, "If a tool used to transport contraband gives off a signal that can be tracked for location, certainly the police can track that signal." And then they cited Knotts. If you might recall the chloroform case where they put the tracking device in the chloroform, you take it the way you find it. And if it's got a device in it, then you take it the way you find it. That was the Knotts decision. And so Skinner, citing that, said that pinging a cell phone repeatedly was not a without a warrant was not a Fourth Amendment violation, because the phone was GPS enabled. Just because the phone was GPS enabled didn't change the calculus for them at all in that regard. And that leads into the last bit that I want to talk about. And the main purpose of me deciding to select this as our topic for this week's Broadcast Blue episode, and that is a case that just came out a few days ago from the Ninth Circuit. So let me talk a little bit about obtaining current cell site location information without a carrier ping. And you might be saying to yourself, "Self, how in the world does that happen?" Well, those gizmos, right? All these gizmos that get invented, and law enforcement finds a way to utilize them. And there's a device. There's different brand names, different types, but the one that's almost ubiquitous now in terminology is the Stingray. So let's talk about this device. Now, this is a device that law enforcement uses, and it's a piece of equipment. And it is a cell site, a cell tower simulator, and it's a device that tricks the cell phone. Remember, a cell phone's a dumb device. It doesn't know what a real tower is from a non-real tower. All it knows is it has a signal that it recognizes, and it's stronger. Remember, cell phones always want to connect to the strongest signal, and this Stingray device, this device tricks cell phones into thinking that it's a real cell phone tower, and its signal is stronger than the cell phone tower the phone's currently connected to. And so the phone disconnects from the real cell phone tower and connects to this device, this Stingray device. Now, you can use the Stingray in a couple different modes. You can use the Stingray to find a known device. If you have a device's MIN, mobile identification number, or IMSI, the International Mobile Subscriber Identification Number, if you have these numbers, and you might have seen them before when you get your little SIM cards to go in your phone, and you have to know what these numbers are in order to get connected to the network, that's what identifies you. It's not your telephone number. That's how information gets routed. But how does the tower know that you have a valid cell phone that can be used on the network? And that is with the MIN or the IMSI. Now, if you know the MIN for a specific phone, you can plug that MIN into the Stingray, and then if you're if you're close enough and you can get this device, this cell phone to connect to you thinking that you are a tower, then you're going to get a direction, a general direction, and a signal strength. So you can pretty much tell from where you're at with the device the direction and the distance the person is away from you. Now, you got to be somewhere in the general vicinity. There's ways that you can kind of find out where they're at. Maybe you ping them and you find out where the last cell tower they were connected to, and you go into that area with your device and you start broadcasting. You start trying to get them to respond to you. If they do respond to your specific MIN identification information, if they do respond, the Stingray grabs the target phone and it gives you this information. Now, the Stingray itself is not a real cell tower, and so the phone isn't going to connect with anybody. If they're talking to someone, then the phone call will be dropped. If they're texting someone, the text won't go through because this device mimics. It's a simulator. It's not a real cell tower. And so it's connecting, but it's not providing in any of the services. So the service, their telephone service, is actually disrupted when they're connected to this device, the simulator, because it's not a real cell tower. In fact, you can see that often in the records for the cell phone company, for the provider, where they say, you know, something happened and service was lost for, at this point in time, it was lost for this amount of time. And that's a pretty good indication that if there's been a Stingray used, you can kind of tell through that disruption of the service. It's important to point out that the Department of Justice had a policy. The Department of Justice came out with a policy a while back that basically said, even though the courts don't require it, it's DOJ policy to get a warrant to use a cell phone simulator. So the DOJ policy is to get a warrant to use the device. Now, I told you there were two modes of operation, that it would find a known device. It will also identify unknown devices. So if you have a cell simulator, and you turn it on in an area, you can get other devices to connect to you and find out what their MIN is. So it kind of works in the opposite direction. You can either identify unknown devices or locate a known device, and it's a different. So there's a few different modes of operation. Now, I told you DOJ policy was to get a warrant, and DOJ came out with that policy even though the courts had said there hadn't been a court say that using the Stingray was a Fourth Amendment event. It was a search under the Fourth Amendment. Well, that changed 4 days ago. As of the date of this broadcast, September 25th, it's only been 4 days. September 21st, just 4 days ago, the Ninth Circuit, in another case called Jones versus United States, the Ninth Circuit expressed Fourth Amendment concerns regarding the use of a cell simulator. Four specific concerns. First, they noted that cell phone tracking, unlike automobile tracking, cell phone tracking can easily invade the right to privacy in a home. Now, the courts have repeatedly said that the home, a person's home, is the chief among equals for Fourth Amendment protection. It is, and so when it comes to tracking vehicles, it's the Fourth Amendment concern is not as heightened as it would be with respect to invading rights of privacy in someone's home. But when you're tracking a cell phone, you could track someone from room to room within their home. And so tracking the cell phone, it can easily invade rights of privacy in someone's home. They also, the second of the four concerns that they had was Mosaic. And they cited the Sotomayor concurrence in Jones in order to express a concern that using this device, getting all of these pieces, the whole concept of Mosaic, this extended type of surveillance information that could be obtained, they cited this and cited the Sotomayor concurrence in the Jones decision as their second concern. The third concern they had was the distinction between the fact the simulator can get real-time location information versus historical information, which is stored, and it's more pervasive. The gathering of real-time location information is more pervasive into privacy rights, and therefore locating a device They noted this distinction here between locating a device and tracking a device. There's a difference between tracking and locating. And then the fourth concern they had was the fact that it wasn't passive. This isn't a passive type of, and that kind of relates to the tracking too, location versus tracking. It's not a passive type of device. It doesn't just sit there and capture information that's being given off. It actively induces a phone to reveal where it is. It actively goes in and fundamentally hijacks the phone by disconnecting the phone from the tower that the person expects to be connected to in order to receive calls and to do what they want to do. It actively induces the phone to reveal the location and hijacks the phone. The only way to keep that from happening is to put the phone in airplane mode and not use it. You have no way to prevent that from happening with these simulators. And so the fact that it's not passive and it actively induces the phone to reveal the location was the fourth concern expressed by the Ninth Circuit in Jones versus United States. And they held that the use of a Stingray, the use of a cell tower, a cell simulator, is a search under the Fourth Amendment that requires a warrant. Now, this is the rule of law now in the Ninth Circuit. It's been policy, DOJ policy, for a while now, but now we have an actual circuit court that says that this is the rule of law. Using the Stingray is a search under the Fourth Amendment. This could go to the Supreme Court too. It's the rule of law in the Ninth Circuit, at least as for now, but it might be coming soon to a circuit near you. Just because you're not in the Ninth Circuit doesn't mean that this shouldn't be a concern to you, especially with the DOJ policy in place as well. This could go to the Supreme Court too. Who knows what's going to happen with this? You're going to have to stay tuned. So that leads me to the summary. It's about time for me to close. That leads me to the summary here. Just to summarize briefly, developments in the legal aspects of obtaining cell site location information, or CSLI, on all fronts, both historical and this real time, including cell tower simulators, are happening. There's a lot of developments happening, a lot of different things going on right now, and you've really, really got to stay tuned for all aspects of the cell site location information. What's going to happen in the Carpenter case? What's the Supreme Court going to say about historical cell site location information? What are other circuits going to do? Are other circuits going to follow the Ninth Circuit with respect to the use of cell tower simulators? And is the Supreme Court going to hear that case? We don't know. We're going to have to stay tuned to see what happens. So there you go. Quick little rundown. I said I'd keep it under an hour. I think I'm at 47 minutes right now, which is about where I want to be. And so I'll go ahead and wrap it up with that. I want to close. Thank you so much. I want to thank you for joining me on this episode of Broadcast Blue. I want to ask you please help spread the word to other local, state, federal, and tribal law enforcement officers. And if you're a prosecutor or an attorney that's listening, spread the word to attorneys as well. Please spread the word about Broadcast Blue. You can subscribe. Click on the subscribe link with your favorite RSS feed at www.broadcast.blue. Our name is our website address. Broadcast.blue is all you have to type in your browser, and you'll get straight to our page. Or look up Broadcast Blue. We're on iTunes and Google Play. Just type search for Broadcast Blue in either iTunes or Google Play and subscribe. And if you have any recommendations, suggestions, or compliments or gripes, please feel free to drop me a line at bruce@broadcast.blue. bruce@broadcast.blue. I'd be happy to hear from you. It'd be great to hear from you out there. And I'd appreciate you again spreading the word. Thank you very, very much for what you do. And I hope you tune in again next week.